was concerned about that because about a half hour before I clicked on the Zoom, somebody set up camp two houses down with a chainsaw.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That's, and I've got like the curtains drawn here to my right, but we may be getting a little bit of that in here and there too. So I apologize.
No worries. It's kind of a part of the, I personally like when stuff like that just kind of comes through. Like,
yeah,
you try to edit it out, but sometimes it's like, you know, these aren't sort of, you know, final, you know, end all things that get,
it's contingent. It's all contingent.
Yeah. So that's, but yeah, no, this is really cool. Yeah. Reading through your books that you sent, the PDFs. Well, first off, the Nick Land concept country thing is like really baffling to me because I don't know if it's like real or not. Like the Praxis Society truce. Like I don't know what's going on there. I just think it's funny and interesting.
That's an accurate read because it's something that a lot of us involved with started because it was fun and funny. And then it turned into from there, like, oh, okay, wait, things could actually happen. You know, once we connected up with some strategies, and this is, you know, like I said, I'm an observer of this angle of things, but picking up with some strategies related to funding via meme coins that some of my colleagues in concept are working with, it was like, okay, well, if we set aside a certain amount of this, this could actually fund something like the zine that we were making jokes about doing. So it just, it's one of those things that starts as something that's almost parody and just kind of gets out of control and takes over in a good way. So, and we're still in the middle of figuring out what it's going to be, but it's definitely going to be a zine that will come out probably within the next month. We're doing finals on Google Docs right now.
Yeah, it's funny that you made that whole kind of thing. You did an acknowledgement to Nick Land because you're sort of playing with hyperstition, but not really. Because I think hyperstition is kind of just a dressed up word for, you know,
for stuff people have always done. Yeah.
To me, it just seems kind of like an empty neologism that people got carried away with and imbued with some sort of metaphysical.
It ain't that deep.
Yeah, it's not deep.
It really
at all.
Is not. Yeah, yeah.
No, I think that's really funny too. I've been sort of following you for a while, and it's been interesting to kind of interact with you. I love a lot of this sort of outer space, you know, speculative, you know, human cosmic architecture and sort of design and layouts that you've been kind of like working on. That's especially,
I know, just, that's been a thread through the conversations that you've had too. Yeah.
Just to introduce yourself, I think that might be good so people have like a little bit more of a frame of reference, because I'm just riffing right now.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Fred Sharman, and my primary gig is architecture academia. So I've been working teaching architecture for about 15 years now. And as part of that, we get to do research, right? In the American research university system, that's a huge chunk of the job expectations for somebody in a tenure track or tenured position. So the focus of my research started, you know, back when I was just getting started as a teacher, when I realized like I could go and dig in deeper about stuff that had always fascinated me as a kid. And it was really that those drawings and paintings of what large scale life in space might be in, you know, what was back in, because I'm a child of the 80s. I was born in 77. So it was back in the 80s, a very near future. And it's something that seemed like very definite if trajectories continued the way they seem to be going. But what I didn't realize is that I was seeing stuff from the 70s before history had kind of ended with things like the oil crisis and currency crisis and all those crashes that happened in the mid 1970s, all those like mini singularities that took place that we're still living in the aftermath of. So what I set out to do was to figure out how to get people in architecture academia interested in this stuff, so to do sort of a two-sided trick, to take some of those visions about long-term human space futures or medium-term human space futures and bring them back to architecture and academia, saying like, hey, you guys should pay attention to this. This is the same stuff that we do every day, right? We think about the future and we think about how life should be or could be, and how we can use ideas about how people could live critically to critique the status quo, basically. And the other side of that trick for me, the other sort of secret agenda for me, is to connect people in science fiction, speculative space science, real space science, to bring them into a space where they can, hopefully communicate, find common ground with people in my home field, which have been thinking about design, affordances, material, construction, and how all that intersects with culture and life and society for hundreds of years, right? People in fields like architecture, urban planning, urban design, landscape architecture. There's a long history of that that space science like too often forgets when they're focusing on the engineering. What temperature does it need to be? What is the atmosphere need to be composed of? All these nuts and bolts things. When it's really a big picture of like, how do we want to live, and how can we use thinking about how we should live to critique ideas about how we're living now?
Wow. Yeah, that's really sort of fascinating that you bring all that up, because that's kind of what I'm trying to do with right to repair stuff at the moment, is trying to broaden it culturally to artists, people who should, I think, ostensibly have take some interest in owning, the means of their own production and sort of owning the goods in a sort of real way, not like this sort of rentier disposable way where, all of our excess sort of ends up on the shores in Ghana. You hit on something really kind of fascinating, talking about the kind of aesthetics of space. Because in the 1970s, like when you talk about being a child of the 80s, the 1970s, and you bring up all these mini crises with the, sort of like Nixonian gold shock. And it was kind of interesting because in the early 70s, you had all of this like wild, fascinating aesthetic and sort of space, because I think people were so horrified at the hard power of World War II and the sort of dropping of the atomic bomb that a lot of these countries got interested in a technology that sort of flexed a kind of national soft power. But out of that came really cool stuff. And then as the sort of financial sector kind of crashed and became further abstracted, we sort of lost that vision and ended in this kind of postmodern intangible of like, well, anything can be anything if it's not material. And we're sort of in this like loop-de-loop, free-for-all rhetorical world because of that. So you hit on a really good point there. How do we get out of that? Like, that's the question I always ask myself,
I mean, for me, it has to be like post nostalgia. We have to like keep going through not only nostalgia about the weird, based golden ages that we see coming up in online culture, but also the nostalgia for those futures from the past, generally those more recent futures from the past. Because it's just too easy to get caught up on and to fall into a trap. So I think aesthetics matter a huge amount, way more than a lot of people realize when we're thinking about
I
utopian
agree.
futures, because it's almost all downstream of the production of desire. And I think that's one of the things that we're interested in experimenting with concept country, is something that's like that will embrace. I mean, you might say post woke, but embrace the woke and embrace the cringe as an engine of aesthetics, as an engine to produce desire, and to break that trap, the dual trap, not only of the Greek statue, Roman centurion on Mars like stuff, but also the kind of swoopy 1970s. I write about the van lines, those lines that are inscribed on like 1970s box vans
Love
that just
those.
goes flat and then like curve and up diagonally and then flat again. And that line, I think for me, that line describes like culture, right? That describes the premonition of the end of a certain kind of future. So fetishizing that kind of line that you still see showing up in like every iteration of like Star Wars, Star Trek, all this just endless like churn of reproduction. They're still reproducing what's basically the end of culture, right? That's what it signifies.
You actually kind of see it on the Houston Astros outfit too.
Yeah.
You know, it's Space
Yeah.
City. I think there might be a kind of correlation there.
No, definitely.
For a while, I've been sort of fascinated by retro lines. You know, and
Yeah.
eBay has this kind of treasure trove of old racing decals that you can look up, and it's just I just screenshot those whenever they come up because there's something about when you talk about kind of going back to lost futures. I mean, I sort of find that that's kind of the most interesting place to look is to look at that period before the Bretton Woodsification of everything, kind of, and the economic sectors just ran wild with endless monetary inflation and ZERP. I'm nostalgic for that period of soft power having this public center in people's minds. Like, that's the nostalgia that I have personally. So I'm really fascinated with that period. But it's hard because a lot of these VCs and technologists, like, they just, you look at Elon, it's just they have such bad taste in things. They're never gonna. Do you think that there's a correlation between, I don't know how to say reactionary politics because I think it's such a hard thing to quantify now, the spectrum. There has to be some kind of correlation between this like ordoliberal tech bro thing and then this just aesthetics don't matter. You know, like let's live
Yeah.
in the cyberpunk dystopia of Bruce Sterling. That let's not look at the cool stuff from the 70s. Let's look at the sort of shitty stuff from the 80s and dwell
Yeah.
in that world. So I don't know.
I think that the Elon sort of constellation is a good example of the current kind of breakdown in the understanding of the role that aesthetics plays, because there's no precision applied at all. Everything is from a sort of a different cinematic universe. The Cybertruck is the it's the Nolan Batman. It's the aliens troop delivery vehicle. It's the broken future that you need to defend yourself against. Whereas the iRobot, the Tesla's robot, right, the same company even, is from this kind of heavily productized, heavily sanitized kind of corporate future that you see in movies like iRobot or movies like AI. And there's the I'm excited by the confusion in the different and the mismatch between those kinds of modes, because that's one of the biggest tells beyond like, posting stupid tweets or whatever, that the fact that this person who's in control of so many companies and could have such a singular effect on culture doesn't know what the fuck he's doing in terms of design.
Right.
Like, doesn't know how to like engage the hardware, the cultural desires, and actually produce something that people can get behind in a more unified way.
Yeah, it's you can sort of see that in X and just, you know, like once that was kind of taken over, because I personally sort of feel like a lot of these platforms, like the user base is kind of assumed to have some sort of aesthetic inclination. If you're sort of making any kind of mass platform, which ends up sort of serving a cultural purpose, it's not just administering information. But I kind of feel like because you have this singular figure who acts as sovereign over these platforms and they just have such bad taste and they're like retweeting AI Pepe the Frogs and just memes from 10 years ago, like that has a kind of, I think, really sort of poisonous effect on the way we kind of process and consume aesthetic content. And then it just becomes this thing of people differentiating themselves by, you know, reposting like, you know, modernist art bot stuff. You know what I mean? It's like
Right.
every,
Yeah.
I think that's kind of problematic in a certain sense. I don't know.
There's the cleaner, sleeker aesthetics have been taken over by a kind of Maoist counter culture counterculture war. That really just becomes the opposite of the hyper-capitalist neo-reaction empire aesthetic, which is really funny. And I think that what and what are the lines out of that, out of those traps? How do you navigate between those two traps? The exciting thing for me is just to keep, and I think this is another thing we're trying to do collectively a little bit, is to keep saying like, okay, more and more and more and more. To keep saying sort of, it's a little cliched, but to keep saying yes and to different worldviews and aesthetics and hyperpopulate possible futures. And push things, it is a little bit accelerationist too, because to speed up the production of possible futures is, I think, going to be ultimately really, really useful, because there'll be a lot on the table. So having, one of the things that has been a touchstone for me, not only as a teacher of architecture, but also as, somebody who engages with, or at least like, as an observer participant in these actual kind of maybe meme ideologies in online culture wars, is to go back to the Zapatista slogan that says, we want a world where many worlds are possible, and there are different variations of that, which is appropriate to the theme. But that overarching sense that, like, okay, that and what else, right? As the next set of questions to ask is really, really exciting to me.
Yeah, no, definitely. The Three Worlds Theory by Mao Zedong. There's Ed has been kind of writing a lot about the sort of astral tendencies in Maoist thought, and I think it's actually really kind of interesting because Mao sort of talks about history as being this series of waves. He was kind of spiral time. I wouldn't say he called it that. But there's this sort of inherent understanding, I think, that comes from maybe the I Ching of like, the unity of dialectics, or this kind of like unity of opposites, and sort of throwing things into these waves of chaos and seeing what sticks. And I think I was at this tech thing recently, just kind of checking it out in town, and I was talking to like these like shark VC startup guys, and they're all talking about Mao now. And it's like, I don't know how much of it is just them kind of retreating from the NRX world and trying to maybe rebrand, or they're just, they keep that sort of idea alive, but they're just obscuring it with something a little bit deeper and more complex. Like so much of it is like, you don't really know what these people believe at the end of the day. It's really hard to see any kind of like fidelity to basically like any kind of political doctrine whatsoever. It's really weird.
Well, Mao's like the ultimate, it's time to build, right? I mean,
Right, yeah.
that's like the core. And also there's something kind of Girardian about that, where they're all so scared. Tech culture in the Bay Area is so scared of China. That's all you hear from, well, Peter Thiel's in LA, but that's all you hear from Thiel, from Andreessen, is that we have to avoid becoming communists so we can beat China, right? They fear communism and they fear China more than almost anything else. And so to emulate or to learn from, in a Girardian sense, your rival is a very appropriate kind of thing to do. One of the things that I wish I had done more of in my second book, which was trying to sort of summarize space futures over the past 150 years, was to pay more attention to China, because they've done a lot. That book was only published in 2021. It was right when China's kind of line of flight was really taking off. The Chinese, like, Sino-futurist, space future aesthetics are really, really interesting. And it's, I think, severely understudied generally. And you look at the International Space Station, and you have, it was descended from, what was originally named Space Station Freedom on the American side. And it was, the Russian side was going to be named Mir-2, which, of course, Mir has that complicated collapse of world and peace into its kind of its own vision of soft power and soft power futures from the Soviet era. And the Chinese station is called Tiangong, which I think is Heavenly Palace, and very, very specific and very different kind of poetic image. And these things matter because this is where this kind of this is where that cultural imagination is being applied. If you say you're going to the Heavenly Palace, that's very different than going to Mir, which is world slash peace. And it's a very revealing look into something like the Sino-futurist imagination.
That's really fascinating. Yeah, and in your book, you sort of mention Tsiolkovsky and biocosmism is sort of, I think, heavily featured. And also Gerard O'Neill. And but one of the things I think is cool about early sort of Russian cosmism and just the Russian avant-garde in general is there primarily was an artistic, aesthetic slant. And, Tsiolkovsky was basically the first person to actually really imagine what physically being in space. And so on one hand, it's like, yes, he was a rocket scientist and he was in, he was invested in this kind of like structural things, but also he was working multi-temporally with this very sort of artistic, aesthetic, philosophical underpinning. And
Mystical, even.
Mystical, very mystical and spiritual.
The cosmists are really fascinating. It's just like so tied up into that the way that the Russian soul was working in that period, right around the turn of the 20th century. I mean, Russian cosmism, for those who don't know, is a worldview, literally almost like a universe view, a cosmos view, that says the sole purpose of human life, the highest and best use that human productivity could be put to, is to eventually resurrect every human who ever lived and give them and us all kind of eternal life. And so, oh yeah, and by the way, we'll have to go to other planets in order to do that, right? That's almost like a side trip, like it's a side effect of the main goal. And that scale of imagination really fascinates me, to take like some basic premise of like, yeah, of course I miss my dad, right? Like he passed away, I'd love to hang out with him again. What if everybody misses their dad? What if we resurrect every single dad, right? And go live in Alpha Centauri? Is to take just the base most basic thing, the most basic human impulse, and turn the volume on it completely up to 11, 12, 13, 14 is wild to me. And that's another thing that I don't think that book is, I don't think that second book is biocosmist enough, because I've learned a lot since then, and this is totally 100% by way of online meme ideology culture, this like production and churn of these little micro belief systems, that it's actually really interesting to think of biocosmism as, and we can talk about this to any extent, but biocosmism as a critique of that cosmist impulse that is basically always looking backwards to, your missing family members, backwards to figures from history that you might want to have a dinner party with, like Mozart or whatever, backwards towards the reproduction of what had come before. Whereas biocosmism, which is really hard to get information about what it was like on the ground in the 19 teens, 20s, and 30s in, the newly Soviet Union, biocosmism seemed to say, no, grandpa, we're not doing that, right? We're going to do our own thing. We're going to do the yes and hyper accelerate the production of new subjectivities, and really enshrine change in those top level goals. So it's not just live forever, it's not just go to space, go wherever you want, but it's also be anything you want and be willing and open to change and enshrine change as part of really identity. And that, I think, is a really, really exciting, that's connected, for me in my mind, to this idea that you go, okay, yes, and what else? What else? What else? What else? Because it's a framework that allows for, it's a world that embraces and encourages the existence of many worlds. And there's not enough about that out there in the literature. And there's definitely, I didn't know that at the time that I was writing, that there was this implicit critique there in the dialectic between cosmism and biocosmism.
But there was also an implicit critique in early biocosmism that held on to the kind of spiritual superstructure of cosmism with the kind of burgeoning atheist tendencies of Marxist-Leninism. So there was also biocosmism, at least from what I've read, was kind of split between this issue with Cosmism is that it looked too far in the past. It was still kind of retrograde in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And they were sort of very interested in this creation of the new man, the new woman, but they also held on to this belief that part of that revolutionary creation of the new subject would also have a kind of spiritual enterprise as well. And that mm-hmm. kind of ran counter to, you know, Stalin was, I think, more sympathetic to metaphysical stuff.
Yeah.
And then Khrushchev was kind of like, you know, elevated the bureaucratic class to this kind of new, he was a vanguardist in that he sort of elevated the scientist and the rationalist and the, mm-hmm. he created a kind of new class of elites, which is what created the split between Mao and Russia, was that Mao was like, bombard the headquarters, get rid of all the smart people. We're crazy world now. And Khrushchev was a little more measured, but it's interesting to see that entire period unfold up until the 1970s as well, during the early sort of onset of the Cold War and the middle period of the Cold War. So it's crazy. History's fun.
That moment, I think, just draws a line under the possibility and the utility of flipping the script in utopian thinking and saying, realizing that, like, it's not that utopian thinking is necessarily always an outside that is in the classical Marxist sense, like something to be avoided, something that's different from the real. And we have real work to do. You know, Khrushchev probably considered himself, I don't know a lot about Khrushchev, but he probably considered himself to be, you know, a proper Marxist in that sense, that he's dealing with the real politic, the real work of bureaucracy, when really what you've created is a utopia for a different kind of subject. You've created a utopia for bureaucrats. You've created a utopia for politicians. You've created a utopia for states, for this pageantry of statesmanship that happens with paperwork and boardrooms, not in terms of, like, you know, palaces and receptions. So it's, you can't, I don't think there is an outside to utopian thinking. And I've been returning a lot to Frederick Jameson since he passed away. And he's really, really direct about this, about critiquing this classically Marxist way to that rejects utopian thinking outright. And pointing out how, no, utopian thinking actually acts as cultural critique, acts directly on an inside, but only from the position of another inside. And that inside is the projection of a possible world that contains within it certain kinds of subjectivities. So that's what I get from particularly Jameson's read of science fiction and the way the roles that science fiction plays in culture as a critical mode. And the way he talks about utopia and dystopia really serving that same function, and the lack of necessity to draw a hard line between the good future and the bad future, because they both function effectively in a critical way to address the status quo. And of course, he outlines other steps that need to be taken to get from the critique to change. And he talks about revolution as upheaval and change in that kind of Maoist sense. But he also talks about the party. He talks about collective effort in order to realize utopian goals, in order to make that connection between that critique from outside, which is another inside, in order to affect another inside and take someone's utopia and turn it into your own.
That's a really interesting point. I mean, even Thomas More, the coiner of utopia, he was interested in bringing that outside inside and sort of folding them together. Everybody had this kind of direct access to a kind of spiritual higher plane.
He got beheaded. I mean, he was not some kind of, you know, Crystal Palace or ivory tower, you know, critic. He was stuff.
I mean, a lot of utopians got beheaded. Just anybody who was trying to unify all those things. I mean, Giordano Bruno, obviously a famous one. I wouldn't say he was a utopian, but he did believe in sort of this infidimensional and pan-dimensional universe that sprawled and encompassed everything and sort of just kind of never ended. And there were no bounds to the expansion of the universe.
Star Trek, basically. I mean, Bruno was basically Star Trek before the fact. And a lot of the, when you do read the few that are available, when you do find, like, on Wikipedia, a biographical sketch of a biocosmos. It almost always ended with like, and then he disappeared into the camps in 1927 and never came out again. Right. So that was Stalin, realizing, I think, the dangers of applied utopian thinking. And to some extent, when you read about biocosmism, you read about a series of like aliases, subterfuges, and alibis. The For a long time, and this is again, it's hard to find. I don't read Russian, and it's hard to find primary texts in translation. But one of the things that, as I understand, that allowed biocosmism to sort of at least exist, if not flourish, in these journals, in the equivalent of what would it be like Tumblr culture or online social media culture today, was that yeah, they were all using alibis, and they were all using, and that goes back to the pre-Soviet era in Russia. Russia's always been a pamphlet culture. A culture of yelling at each other behind pseudonyms and stuff like that about politics. But they were considered, when they were on the radar of power, they were kind of ignored at best, or just sort of like, oh, that's cute. You want to have restructure society in outer space 10,000 years from now? Nice. You guys keep going ahead with that. That's fine, as long as you keep coming to your job every day. It was seen as mostly harmless because of the scale involved and because of the almost ludicrous nature of the proposal. And I think that's still really useful to learn from today, to make outlandish claims and make outlandish demands is still useful as a political strategy, especially
100%.
behind, maybe with a like-minded kind of group chat as the core, and then a set of public-facing entities that can do the agitprop behind pseudonyms. And now, increasingly, those pseudonyms are actually automated to some extent. There are these, AI agents, the group chats, and this is like the kind of thing that I really get into as a participant observer, to watch these formations of these microcultures in real time. The group chats produce the meme coins in order to fund the primary cultural production project. And the hard work, or the actual like sort of street level pamphleteering, is done by automated AI agents, which is really, really, it's almost just like, and I know you know this territory really well, Barry, it's almost like this post-Milady kind of adaptation and reappropriation of strategies that, and I'm still, I'm not, I know we're in a kind of post-woke, end of culture war moment, but I'm still a kind of libtard at heart, and I always will be. So I recognized Milady when I discovered Rumeliacorp. I was like, these people are my absolute ideological enemies, but the things they're doing are really, really freaking interesting. So it's great to see the second generation.
I mean, the post-woke thing is interesting too, because I personally don't think we should get rid of identity politics in terms of marginality. It's just, I think Derrida had a lot of really good points, and Francois Laruelle and some of the post-structuralist, on that marginality is quasi-historically contingent, and the margins, they shift. And marginality offers a place of possibility. Like when we look at, the American Indians, they're clearly within the margin. And by studying people who are marginalized, we can intimate possible futures that the hegemon can't show us.
Right. That's
So
the Zapatista critique again.
I'll never be one of those people who's like, I support the, I am pretty woke in that way. It's just, I think that there was a weird blip in that. For some reason, in 2016, the culture wars kind of created a new kind of, because of how media was controlled and administered, it did create a kind of new variety of marginalization that kind of repressed a certain sect of people. But now it's like, no, they have full control of all media. So there's that possibility is shot. I have no interest in any of that, because now they've managed to gain that power, but through that they've kind of lost a lot of maybe their more interesting critiques of the liberal status quo. It's been lost, and it's been completely overshot into oblivion. And
Yeah.
let's put the brakes on this and think about it for 1 second. And now it's like you have two mass shooters who are directly inspired by this shit. And it's like,
if you're halfway online, you know exactly what this is plugging into. Yeah. One of the things I should have sent you, some of this thread too, from my own sort of side research and writing. One of the things I've been writing about since 2021, 2022, in a back channel on Substack hosted by my homie Marcos, shout out the Ain't Shit Show. He sort of let me have a little platform on his Substack, and I decided I would write about research into what I think of as the theory of the evil nerd as a way of remarginalizing. Did I send that out?
Yeah, I've seen that. That's an interesting theory.
I've posted that in a couple of different places. Of course, x.com doesn't like Substack these days, but for me, that project is the remarginalization of NRX, to say like, oh, that's cute, you know, oh, you're doing that, like, that's funny. I understand exactly what that is.
Yeah,
you can keep doing that as long as you're not bothering anybody.
Right.
And for me, the fundamental, and I guess there's a current manifestation of that in the Nick Land acknowledgement that we wrote for Concept Country. The fundamental aspects of NRX are so easily reducible to like things that are basically like silly, I think, of neo-reaction. They're fundamentally unhappy. They don't actually want to win, which puts them in a really weird position right now, where they're now the hegemon, basically. and their ideology just basically comes down to a hierarchy fetish.
Right.
There's no way for this worldview to recognize difference in any other terms but, oh, this is better than that, and that's better than this other third thing that's then repressing me. So, which is just, it's just silly and it's limiting. It's like it's the worldview of an angry 6-year-old. And it's going to be really interesting to see that angry 6-year-old have like public temper tantrum after temper tantrum in culture at large. I mean, it's going to be dangerous. Already is dangerous. Yeah. But I think that's what we're seeing right now, is the effects of a worldview that's just built on an inability to do anything else but create ranked lists, you know, which is essentially a nerd thing to do. Like your top 10 movies, who would win in a fight between Batman and Superman, whatever. But that only gets you so far, and that's only so interesting for so long.
I think the biggest problem is they don't know how to build culture. They only know how to sort of react to it and take from it. And this was sort of a criticism of the kind of early art and the mechanics of the capitalist age and some of these like early Soviet texts when they talk about reactionary art, is that at a certain point, reactionary art can only render. And what is rendering today? Rendering is no longer, you know, artist guilds in the 1300s who had a lot of skill. Rendering is the proliferation of slop, you know, and sort of this kind of easy rhetorical discursive rendering of lists, criticism. It's like
the lowest form of AI use is like, summarize this like for me. I don't have time to actually deal with that or engage with that. Just give me the 500 word version of it.
Yeah, I mean, and this is kind of why public diffusion in terms of AI, I think, is interesting, because there's human curatorial input. You could potentially, you know, because of that, there are ways that we can actually take it and do things with it that maybe aren't slop and maybe could potentially aid another 100. Sort of, you know, creative expanse. I know the photographer, John DeVola, he's always done this thing where he takes like pictures of these graffitied abandoned places and says, but he's been doing this thing, and he's old now. He puts this like a AI slop image in the middle of the graffitied wall with the sunset and kind of combines the two.
Stuff.
And I've always been really interested in stuff like that. I think if it can liberate other faculties to create things and, you know, think about new forms and think about the way we engage with old forms. Can we ephemeralize them? Can we make them more useful to just the average person? These aren't really questions of the evil nerd, because I have a little bit more of an egalitarian You know, I'm like the Megalopolis. Like that movie made me cry. Like I love
so amazing.
It, yeah, it was like my dream world. Just I
literally got choked up at the end of it.
Me too.
I swear I did. Yep.
And it's crazy to say this, but like I became such like a diehard Megalopolis stan. You know, the way like a Marvel movie person would like to just like, I was like, oh, finally something, a hill I can really just die on. Mm-hmm. You know?
And that the, I think one of the things that I get from architecture generally that I think is translatable to this maybe other way of working with the world that's not reactionary, that's productive and future forward and progressive is a really beat word, but I don't want to go there. But
no, you should. Is that progressive is fine.
Reclaim it, right?
Yeah. Why
I mean,
not?
That was right. I did one of the story arcs I draw in class is the ascendance of the word progressive into the ascendance of sustainability, and now the watchword is resilience. Right? You go from like things are going to get better to well, at least we could prevent things from getting worse, to resilience, which is, you know, a huge watchword in urban design and architecture. Is a worldview that says bad things are going to happen, and you better prepare to at least bounce back from the inevitability of like some kind of partial collapse, which is a really telling, you know, through line too, I think, in culture through the past like 70 years. But the other thing that I think is applicable from architecture, and I should say, you know, I'm an architecture professor at a very big state school, very big public school. Historically Black college and university. My opinions are my own. I'm not speaking for, you know, anybody I work for or anything about the institution at all. But one of the things I love about architecture is that it's always about playing well with others, that there's not the assumption of a hierarchy right from the start. In terms of getting anything done, you have to bring in other disciplines and listen to them on their own terms and have conversations with them as equals, right? Not in a kind of hierarchical mode. But also in design, you're constantly seeking to surprise yourself. You want to sit down and you want to help bring into the world something that you've never seen before, even as its own steward or its own kind of helper in its manifestation. You want to be surprised and you want to come away with the notion that more things are possible today than they were yesterday. And I think that kind of use of AI agents is of a piece with the way architects have historically used things like the diagram, where you make a little sketch and then you sort of go, okay, what could that mean? What scale is that thing? What can that do if I put it into a world or a site? How can it develop and unfold? Or you work with materials. You say, can I bend this? What does this do when I bend it? What does it do when I cut it or fold it, slice it and put it back together again? You're always bouncing some kind of basic intention off of something else besides you, and then getting information back that you can then use to surprise yourself and make something new. So it's really the same. I haven't used AI tools myself a lot, but I enjoy like studying how others use AI tools. And I enjoy encouraging students to use AI tools in different weird ways, but not to summarize or tell you, you know, reassure yourself, but to surprise yourself. Mm. That's, I think, the necessary part.
That's a really good point. I think surprising yourself is, when you're surrounded by too much of the same stuff, it can be really sort of problematic, especially
we produce slop. Yeah. We get stuck in our own slop, right, like all the time. There shouldn't be a surprising failure mode because we do it to ourselves, you know, on our worst days constantly.
Right. I'm really sort of fascinated by your experience, you know, teaching at a large public school, you know, and teaching architecture and like, would you say that with all of these new tools and obviously that, would you say that they've kind of changed the way people engage with thinking about public spaces on just kind of like a very kind of molecular level? Can you see that seeping into the public more? Because we're not talking about just like online stuff. You're actually in person teaching people. So
I think it's an exciting thing for, and this is another reason why I love Megalopolis, is it's an exciting thing for architects and people who make the built environment to like collaborate with these non-human entities almost in a subversive way.
Right.
To bring them back to the public realm. So it's almost like we have this, I sometimes think of it as we have this kind of secret pact with other agencies that like I say, like I said earlier, is has basically always been the case with architecture and design. We want other things to come in and influence us. But the other side of that coin is we want to lift them up and give them power to help remake the world, because we all need collaborators to remake the world. So I see what's exciting to me about architecture and urban design and all the other related fields right now is that it feels like you're at the core of a conspiracy to change the world, like in a disciplinary group chat,
That's
in a whole
awesome.
field that is the secret cabal that is conspiring with these other entities from outside of time and space, maybe, to come and remake everything else, which is totally a through line in Megalopolis too, that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, the stopping of time thing I think was really kind of interesting because Kojève, some he mentioned something about how, time is this kind of thing that's human. It's like there's a cosmic time there, and then there's this sort of perceptible, there's the dialectical time of history. And so basically what he's alluding to is that cosmic time is actually space, and space is actually architecture. So I think
So structuring it becomes paramount.
comes, yeah, exactly. And I think that that's just why we need googie fast food restaurants. We need to be utopianists. Like you, and you brought up a really great point about how utopianism and futuristic thinking is kind of the ultimate criticism, because we look at this kind of pseudo-Freudian stuff that we see online, this kind of like schlocky. First off, if we learn anything from Kant, it's that we don't really, none of us really know the direct psychological makeup of an individual person. Like those complexities aren't things that we can just kind of generalize and just be like, oh, this kind of person does this and this kind of person does that. That's,
Type of guy theory.
yeah, I don't really buy into that thing. We can relate to people, but it's not, I mean, it is kind of interesting to see how this future thinking is, it makes a lot of people angry, to hear Meg, which is why Megalopolis made so many people angry, because like even the use of stock footage, in the Hippodrome sequence, and it was just like the way he sort of cross-cut these different images, it's like there's something about it that's kind of cringe. But it's complete, but it's
Totally.
uncharted in a strange way too. And it's like, why can't we, ultimately, this is what's going to break us out of the other stuff. It's not, appealing to sort of conceptions of taste as they stand. That's status quo at this point. So.
And that's what I like about type of guy theory is that you it's not just no one is reducible to a type of guy, which is actually extraordinarily liberating. It's that same question of how you can structure time or structure space. You can structure your experiences of those things in the same mode. You can the It's the corollary to the online joke about making up a type of guy to get mad at, is that you can make up a type of guy to be like, yeah, that's who I want to be at the end of the week, the guy who's type of guy who's gone running 5 times or something like that, right? You can make up the type of guy to aspire to be, and then you can be that, which again is like, okay, yeah, that's hyperstition, that's like fiction turning into the future, but it's also just like setting personal goals and being accountable. But I think type of guy theory is useful in that same way that you have to recognize the type of guy always has an outside, or that there's an irreducibility. There's always an N plus one to the type of guy, which for me is a useful, that's been a useful kind of way of being, maybe call it post-woke online, is to eliminate these, to get beyond these culture wars and go like, I can make friends among the based, right? Like, even if I am cringe and woke, and we can talk about stuff. Because nobody's reducible to the type of guy or girl or they or them that they're playing or aspiring to be or getting mad at on the internet. There's still an N plus one, and that's liberating. It's liberating for relationships. It's liberating for self-work. It's liberating for all kinds of things.
That's, I mean, yeah, that's a really good point. How much of that, though, and this is kind of the thing that I run up against is like, you know, like I sort of feel like people kind of get reduced very easily. Like when you say they, that it's like that they, you know, people who are of newer subjectivities, like they're not a monoculture, you know,
right.
Especially if you talk to them, you would be really shocked to find that they have wildly different views about things than, you know, each other within these kind of newer types of subjectivities. And so it's just, I mean, just
guy is gender neutral, I think here.
Right. Yeah. Right. No, totally. Yeah.
Well, it's really Deleuzian, isn't it? I mean, that's another thing, you know, I'm a child of the 80s, but I'm a, you know, a student of the 90s. I still find so much that's useful in Deleuze, especially with regards to thinking about difference.
Right.
Because is there a difference? How many different types of difference are there? Is difference only existing in relationship to some kind of center or assumed baseline default? No. All kinds of contemporary subjectivities are working that out at street level, which is really exciting too. That there's just so many different kinds of difference. And, you know, I like to read René Girard a little bit too, just in that same kind of know your enemy mode. And for Girard, who talks about mimesis and copying the type of guy you want to be, you know, that kind of method is useful. But for me, in the end, he reduces everything to sameness. Everything is, and this is Peter Thiel's favorite philosopher, of course, right, who he was a student of at Stanford. Everything is ultimately the same kind of relationship, this relationship that that says, well, we need to eliminate that type of guy, instead of realizing the basic mutability of desire and the construction of energy that moves things into new territories. If there is a war, it's the war between difference and sameness. Mm. And what I love about difference is that it also includes sameness too, right? This is again a world where many worlds are possible. You can keep doing that thing over there. That's cute. You all are doing that. But you know, we're working on a bigger project over here and you can come join. But if you don't want to do that, don't bother anybody. Right? Don't restrict anybody else's three primary kind of privileges. The right to persist in time, to maybe live forever if you can. The right to go anywhere, and the right to be anything. As long as you're not like getting in the way of those three fundamentals, then keep playing, you know, I Love Lucy in Outer Space or whatever. We'll be over here when you need us.
That's an interesting point. The whole thing about difference, I think, is really kind of, you know, I know nothing about René Girard. Like, haven't looked into him. Don't know.
He has like one idea. This is the sameness thing too. He has exactly one idea. He just applies it to everything. Like everything is the sacrifice. And even, okay, well, why do people kill and eat animals? Well, they do that because they originally started sacrificing them. And then they decided, why would we throw out this meat? We should just eat it. So this is, it's like literally his answer to everything. Is the Girardian scapegoat and sacrifice.
Huh.
No, it's not. It doesn't have anything to do with actual anthropology at all.
Yeah.
That's, it's just this, it's like, it's human culture fanfic, you know, that he's right. just writing that reassures a certain type of guy too.
Yeah. The Peter Thiel thing, also looking at the concept country and seeing the AI Peter Thiel's head exploding. That was really funny. But now it's like you're seeing Thiel, and it's not just eliminating difference of subjects, it's also eliminating difference of economics. You know, there's this whole notion that Peter Thiel is a, you know, limited government libertarian, but he openly says he likes monopolies and doesn't like market competition. I'm err on the side of Schumpeterian, Jeffersonian democracy with kind of post-Marxist characteristics. If that sounds obscure, I'm sorry, but that's where I come from. That's where I'm coming from. That kind of pisses me off. In order for you to enact your kind of libertarian monarchist LARP of sovereignty, you need absolute state sanctioning and approval and contracts, which is why you see Anduril and Palantir popping up on these kind of extremely Reddit tier commercials and like college football games now, where it's like trying to be stylish and
it's
subversive.
So funny.
And it's like, you're just missing the mark. Like you're already so behind, you have all this capital driving this and you're so behind. It's just, it's crazy, you know?
And that's what, that's the current set of trend lines, you know, even with that contradiction bound up in them, that's the current set of trend lines for creating and thinking about material space futures in real terms, in like policy terms right now. In 2015, I don't know if you've studied this or followed this, but in 2015, two companies, Planetary Resources and Deep Space Industries, lobbied the Obama administration to create a new law that would protect property in outer space. Because, and this is because people were worried about, people meaning private investment actors in the space domain, were worried about a really utopian document, the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, that the United States and, you know, tons of other countries are signatories to it. Yeah. A lot of people in international law will say like, hey, at this point it's customary. Like, even if you're not signing this thing, it obtains and it, you know, has some power to control your behavior in space. What it says is that you can't claim property, that no nations can claim sovereignty over territory. That flag on the moon that the Apollo astronauts put, it was, there's a special law that says that is not an implicit claim of territory because that would violate the Outer Space Treaty. So in 2015, these private industry actors successfully lobbied the Obama administration at the time to create this law, the Space Act of 2015, that says, okay, you can't claim sovereign territory, but you can claim and utilize material. So I can mine the moon if I have the capability to do so. I can refine the products of that mining and create aluminum and silica glass. You can get oxygen out of the lunar regolith. It has water bound up in it atomically. I can do all that and make stuff and still claim that that stuff that I made is mine. And so this was the space sort of libertarian ideology reaching to the state, going, this is doing exactly what you just described. You have to go right to the state and say, hey, can you make sure nobody takes my stuff and that I can actually keep this stuff? Because otherwise, why would I bother going and making it, right? You have to enforce property rights first. Right. All these libertarian, you know, great frontier companies wanted to go right to the core of the state and make sure that their property rights would be protected before investing. And the funniest like sidebar to me is that both those companies immediately went bankrupt. They spent almost their entire runway on lobbyists getting these laws passed, and the companies themselves no longer exist. So they didn't bother like building up actual technical capability to do the stuff they said they wanted to do. They wanted property rights.
Right. Would you say that that's kind of what's going to happen to like Praxis Society or any of these, I don't know, you know, quote unquote based city state kind of ventures that are being charted out today? Or
there's no outside for them to occupy is the thing. And so they need some kind of extension of power to secure a bubble within a perceived outside so that they can do the things they say they want to do. I mean, the current set of goals, I think, is to just look outside the global North and the global West. And then wherever they go, they find the power relationships still obtain. You can't stay in Prospera if the voters kick out the right-wing regime that signed your contract. They could just pass a new law and say that contract's no longer valid. You can't be here anymore. Go back to home or go to Lisbon or go to wherever, right? So there's an attempt to get outside that then it needs an extension of the same structures that you're trying to get outside of in order to maintain the existence of this bubble that you think you have. So there is no, this is one of the things that in my own work, I have this list of like weird questions that I don't, or weird provocations to self that I don't know what they mean. And one of them, one of the ones that I've been returning to again and again in writing and on Twitter is this idea that there is no outside anymore. That in a number of different ways, human culture is affecting the planet in a way as if it were one continuous influenceable superstructure,
right?
That you cannot get outside of it. we cannot go to space to get outside because all of the limitations of technical capability and vulnerability and extreme environments immediately come back to bear. And even these regulatory frameworks, like the Outer Space Treaty, which I could say more about, I think it's one of the most utopian pieces of writing that human cultures have ever created. These things already pre-frame an outside and already create a kind of even a pre-regulatory structure that's just not built out yet, and that will need to be built out if anybody wants to end up doing anything in these territories.
That's really interesting. I think about that a lot, and it's just kind of like this idea of if there is no outside, if outside and inside have been sort of fully collapsed, what does that look like? And I think it's just sort of, to me, it's just sort of like basic public consensus. You know, how do we engage with the public? How do we engage with things that aren't, you know, like Hobbesian and overly kind of, you know, because ultimately, I mean, just, you know, in evolutionary biology itself, it's like the species that collaborate the best are the ones that actually survive. It's not the strongest. I think that's, you
It's not a
know,
hierarchy fetish.
no, the hierarchy fetish doesn't actually stack up, which I think is a, it's a big problem that the people who are now in charge have the hierarchy fetish. And because we're not like, you know, like the conservatives of the, you know, 20th century, they were way more moderate in their, I think part of that was just a basic under, you know, sort of underpinning of Christian moral value system, which always kind of lends itself to a kind of, you know, public egalitarianism. But now that that's gone, I think it's, you know, it's incredibly, I think it's pretty dangerous, honestly. I think we haven't even seen the start of it. You know, it's weird. So
It's going to get weirder before it gets
less
more
weird.
legible for sure.
Yeah.
One of the, and this is sort of aligning with your idea about right to repair. The Outer Space Treaty sort of speaks to that a little bit too. It speaks to the necessity for mutual aid given the dangers in this domain. It says that, and this is coming out of the Cold War, remember, and written at a time where nobody knew who would really win this space race. So everybody was invested in setting up these structures where nominal enemies would be required to help each other, right, in this shared struggle. And so that environment created pieces of other texts like Article 5, which says that, if I remember right, like in carrying on activities in outer space and celestial bodies, etc., astronauts of one state party shall render all possible assistance to astronauts of any other state party. So, and this is a big top-level document, the kind of thing like a kind of document like the Declaration of Independence that declares, you know, here are our basic foundational values, and here's what we're going to sort of take as basic requirements for anybody that wants to play along in this new system, whether it's the United States or whether it's outer space, is that, hey, you have to help each other. So this document has basically enshrined mutual aid in the entire universe, right? If we follow it through to its ultimate conclusions, the way the cosmos logic does, then we've created a superstructure. We've created a pre-regulatory framework for mutual aid, the right to repair, interoperability, right? If you need oxygen and I have the capability to provide oxygen, I need to make sure I can plug into your tank somehow. Right, so there are real implications downstream of those ideals that have to do with the basic dumb stuff like hardware protocols and standards, or you know what in my world I would recognize as building code. If I'm in a fire emergency, I need to know the door handle is going to be where I expect it to if I can't see because of the lights are out or it's smoke. And so all across the globe, in the EU, in the UK, in the US, door handles are specified and required to be within about the same height range. because of that,
Yeah.
because of things like that.
Right.
So that kind of, this is why what I argue is a consequence of, and again, this is a utopian consequence. I'm trying to bring this, I'm trying to hyperstition this into reality. And some space lawyers who are friends even agree with me on this. But what I argue is that the implications of that mutual aid, that right to repair, that responsibility to help that are enshrined in the Outer Space Treaty, basically mean that space won't be the most libertarian environment that humans have ever created culture within. It'll actually be the probably the most regulated environment that humans have ever created culture in, because otherwise that culture that's created in that domain is not going to last 5 minutes.
Exactly.
So, and I think that happens. I think we can apply that same logic to Earth too, not only to eventually say, well, Earth is in space, so why not here, right? That's the critique of a status quo that's possible within utopian thinking. But it also attains in terms of, well, anybody who's gonna disavow that biological fact that organisms that collaborate are more successful than organisms that compete, anybody that's going to attempt to apply that in the real material world is not going to be able to stick around for very long, much less build cultures that are going to persist.
Those are great points. Looking at Earth as something that's also a part of space, this Article 5 thing is really kind of interesting to me, 'cause I remember, even when I was a kid, you sort of talk to people of the older generation, the 70s babies and sort of late 60s generation, and I'm always struck by how many of them wanted to become astronauts. That was a popular thing, just kind of general trope, is that you ask a little kid, like, what do you want to be when you go? I want to be an astronaut. How many kids just wanted to go to outer space, where they could? And I think Zizek is wrong that outer space isn't dumb. I think it's the frontier where the smartest things can happen, because we've already, some of the dumb things, I don't want to say they're totally irreversible, but when you talk about the place where there needs to be the most collaboration, we can see that today. But I think overproduction of commodities is a massive problem that can only really be solved through a global strategy to reduce waste. And I think right to repair is kind of the first. I think it's one of many stones that you're going to have to throw at this thing. But I think because it has so much traction from many different kinds of subgroups and political subcultures from just all across the spectrum, I think that's one area that we can really kind of hit on and be like, all right, this is our path towards mutual agreements that this is bad. We can all agree, we shouldn't be, things shouldn't be getting worse when you run a software update on them,
Do you know that no one's ever studied the trash on the International Space Station?
No. Wow.
No one has ever, and it's been up there for 23 years now, continuously occupied. No one has done any kind of study to see what's being discarded, partly because it just is left to burn up in the atmosphere. And we think of these kind of futures as places where some kind of ultimate recycling, should be desirable or possible. But right now, astronauts, when the clothes get worn out, there's no laundry facilities. They get thrown in the trash and they have new clothes that come up. So every few
Wow.
days, there's a discard of like a whole outfit because you can't even really take a shower. You can do basically a sponge bath, but you definitely can't do laundry. So, and then that's, that's even aside from the question of what is useful in discarded food containers, what's useful in hardware that people think they no longer need. So one of the things that we're trying to do as part of the International Space Station archaeological project is to ask, what's in the trash? What are you discarding that could be useful on the one hand, just in utilitarian terms, but also like revealing about how people are building culture in these new places, which is I there's so I love like these territories because you can easily start asking what seem like really basic duh questions and nobody's asked them before. Like, hey, what are the astronauts all throwing away? So there's this, there is this heroism about the figure of the astronaut until you, and then there are other layers come in. Like, I haven't bathed in like 9 months, right? I haven't had a shower in 9 months, and I throw away my undershirt every 4 days, but I wear it till then, and it's not great on day four. And I th one of the other implications is that the astronaut as this kind of heroic figure is, I think, a really unique type of guy to want to be, right? You want to be the best that is, and literally in the Outer Space Treaty, it's like an envoy of humanity, is how they describe the role of the astronaut. But also, what the Outer Space Treaty says explicitly, like, hey, part of what goes along with this role is that you're required to help people. And
Right.
if you don't help people, we'll haul your ass in front of the Hague, right? Like,
Right.
you'll go to international court, which, that's another wrinkle, which is like international law really has effectively no teeth, especially if you're an American. The Americans have literally said fuck you to the international courts in the Hague and said, basically dared them, said, come on, try it to any potential future challenge or pursuit of American individuals. But I think it's interesting to think about, and it's interesting to go, okay, yes, I see. This is what it says. So let's do it. Let's follow through on the ideals.
That's really interesting. You're bringing up so many good points right now. It's like, I'm sort of like, just to kind of go back to the aesthetic side of things in the 1970s, like what do you think a good way to get artists and people involved in, entrenched cultural institutions, like what do you think it's going to take to get them to care about this stuff? Like this is something I think about a lot because I would say I'm an anti-work person. Like I think we should just let the machines do the work. I know you mentioned you had a meme where it's like the dumb guy and the smart guy are like, let the machines do the work, and the midwit is like, I want to work, and I'm like, yeah, that's actually a per to me, that sums up the kind of the general consensus around outsourcing labor. It's like this should be something that I think a lot of people in my, I don't know, cultural world would get behind. This idea that we can reduce labor time to, 15 hours a week. We have
The Keynesian common task.
And for whatever reason, or this idea that, we don't have to throw away our commodities, we can modularize them and repurpose them and sort of upgrade them ad infinitum. Like that seems like something that would appeal to like artists, but it's like they're still kind of, I guess you could say, status-wise, it's unsexy, It's a lot easier to be like, I want to be in a white wall gallery show and I want to, have like a monograph written about what I do that dresses up the work and the art. But I do think, at least for me, it's like if people who are invested in culture and cultural production aren't invested in the infrastructural uncool parts, then they don't get a right to complain about the outcome. Or if cultures become a monoculture or things have become corrupt, because eventually we're gonna we kind of get what we deserve in the end. So how do we get out of that? That's something that I'm always constantly thinking of.
Yeah, I think it's like maybe one of the hugest open questions here, right? We were talking about lines earlier, and I love, again, I go to Deleuze, who writes about a line as a metaphor, or a line as a vector, and some kind of phase space, but it's also for him like a literal line drawn on a page. And the way different kinds of lines act on and exist because of different kinds of cultural conditions, that way that we can identify, that I can say, like, that you and I can say the lines from the 70s, and we both know what we're talking about. Hopefully, some listeners know what we're talking about too. But that's very different than the line from the 80s, the type of line. And it's the is it Frederick Kiesler who writes about affect theory? I forget, in art and architecture, affect theory. So the sort of the way the way a line is, there's the Greek line and the Roman line in terms of the way the body brings weight to the ground in sculpture and in art, and the fluidity, right? The Egyptian line is a very specific triangular with 1 foot forward, 1 foot back, and you can understand how the body is a structure in space and how limiting that is. The Greek line is the contrapposto, the S curve, right? And the angles between shoulders and hips that mirror one another. What is the what I think, and this is not an answer, but it is a way that we would recognize it if it showed up, is what is the line of the 2020s? What is the type of line of even the United States in the 2020s, or the United States in the 21st century? What would a future art historian look back on and say, that's so emblematic right there? It could be anything. It could be anything out there in this churn of culture, and we wouldn't even know it to see it today, but we might know it in retrospect.
I kind of think the line of the 2020s would look something like, I don't know, like it would be like a spiky H.R. Giger type of thing, you
Yeah.
know? I think of something, I don't know.
The nearest thing that comes to mind right now as we're talking is the Hyper America flag.
Of
That's like the
course.
fractal, it's like the different scale stars and stripes that are somehow fractal and infinite. That idea of Hyper America is something that's still really exciting, because that
I
seems like a
agree.
gesture towards worlds that contain many
Worlds.
possible
Yeah,
worlds.
well, it's hyper Walt Whitman, you know, it's
It's
like,
hyper Walt Whitman, exactly.
yeah.
Walt Whitman in space would be based.
It would be.
That kind of line, that kind of aesthetic. And I think it probably will be an AI-inflected aesthetic. The AI line right now is very goopy. I don't know. I
Ah,
find
you're
it
right.
hard to articulate, but there's, I mean, you can't, and I, as a teacher, I can read the text from a million miles away and tell if it's the direct result of an AI summary. And I feel like I can, this is why I want to be immersed in these cultures, because I was scared of it initially. But I feel like I can still tell from a good distance, like that particular kind of AI goopy line, that and that sort of vaguely shiny surface that shows up. So there are hints, there are like weak signals of different types of line that are emerging from Hyper America right now. Just don't know what they'll coalesce into right now yet.
Yeah, I think of like the kind of smudging, the early blending of techniques in oil painting from kind of like the Dutch masters and stuff like that. Like I think that's a specific type of line. And then you almost see, you know, after the fall of the Holy Roman Empire, you start to see that within Dutch painting, you know, with like Bruegel the Elder, the lines actually become more defined, and it's almost like this precursor to modernism within
There's this
artistic
kind of
production. Yeah,
bulbous
there's like this
body.
bulbous little guys holding clay, and there's something really interesting about that to where you can kind of trace lines to culture based on what's being produced in culture. Like when you talk about the line of the 1980s, I think of like the jazz cup. You know, or something like that. It's like a squiggly,
That's, yeah.
disconnected, you know,
Fake gesture,
fake.
kind of overly affected trace of a fake gesture.
I definitely like 70s lines. There's
Yeah, big
something,
time. Me too.
it's there's something so cool about stuff from the 1970s to me. I'm just obsessed with it. Like if I could forever, I've always been talking about that. I've always been like, I feel like I was just from the 1970s and I just woke up in the wrong decade. And I've always been so fascinated by the kind of just those autumn colors of like red, brown, orange stripes and you know, like the kind of you
We
can
had in my house growing up, we had the wood paneled walls, but the furniture was orange and brown plaid. And
Ah,
it was
love
like
it.
this, because everything, the other thing that got folded in was this other kind of Hyper America, the 70s, because there was the bicentennial.
Ah,
So everybody's
yep.
going back to the colonial period and refinding all these things. And the
And that
carpet was bright
bicentennial
blue.
video is so trippy, you know?
Yeah.
It was like just psychedelic. There's also the like everything has this like opaque Quaalude quality to it.
Yeah.
It's just, there's something about it that's just so whooshy and weird.
Quaalude colonialism.
Yeah. I think that's a good thing to name Space Colin, is be like Quaalude colonialism. That would be a good one.
Oh. Well, do you know the other thing I come back to is the Ant Farm Cadillac Graveyard Project? Do you know this? In Texas, it's like the butt ends of a bunch of classic 1950s Cadillacs sticking out of the ground. It's still there.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they were art and architecture. They were weirdo speculative utopian art and architecture practitioners in the 70s. I mean, it's a one-liner at some level. You're like, aha, Cadillacs buried, you know, face down in the side of the road in Texas. But what they were really studying was the variations on the tail fins, the subtle kind of changes from year to year, model to model, which, you know, are created in these boardrooms and these art studios to try to keep up with and produce new kinds of cultural futures, right? That's what they were really, really interested in, is just taking a close look at those lines and comparing them on a year by year basis and thinking about, you know, what they might mean or what effects they might have had at the time.
Yeah. You know, Baudrillard, he had some pretty good things to say about the desert, I thought, and about the kind of expanse of Utah and the Great Basin. And you can almost,
and horizons,
you can really apply the same things to outer space. As you said, that the desert is an ecstatic critique of culture. You know, you could say outer space is an ecstatic critique of culture too, because it's, you know, it's not something that's, you know, we can obviously sort of marvel at the power, the subtectonic power of sedentary rock. And, you know, we could look into geology is very sort of tangible. You know, we'd be like, oh, wow, this makes our concerns look extremely paltry. I don't know if you've ever seen an erupting volcano. I just went my first time to Sakurajima, and just to be that close and be like, okay, yeah, like the things that are going on in my head on a social level are, this is kind of, you know, we have to give reverence to this. You can almost say that space is kind of a similar thing, you know?
Yeah. And the lines that you see in space include, the line of enclosure, right? That's almost the most important line, the line between the air you can breathe and the lack of it outside. And that line tends to create, you know, almost like a bubble in a solid. It's almost like a figure ground reversal, where everything, it's another way to say there's no outside. The hard vacuum may as well be solid rock for all, you know, I can inhabit it in an unaided way. But what would be the type of line or the aesthetics of the encounter with that? I mean, too often we fall back on the sublime, but also it's like the just eternally useless. Buzz Aldrin called the moon something like exquisite desolation when he landed. You know, the sense that beyond the desert, because the desert is still in some sense there for you to engage with in some kind of way. One of the things that I think is so fascinating about thinking about space environments is the utterly anti-utilitarian quality, that this is not for you. You are here in this incredibly provisional way. And you will go away, and there may be a footprint, there may not be. But this is fundamentally not for you. This is about something else entirely.
Yeah. You know, thinking about some of my fascination with the hyper-America of Baudrillard or Walt Whitman, you know, Baudrillard he said a lot of stuff about the desert and about these empty spaces. Also, he was like, it's an extension of the inner silence of the body. And the most famous thing he said about the desert is it's an ecstatic form of disappearance. And space is the most ecstatic form of disappearance because we don't even know where the guy's trash goes, you know, when they, like there are so many things about it that we just don't know. You know, for somebody like Heidegger, the ultimate critique would be something, you know, shot through the prism of death. You know, there's this obsession with death, and, you know, particularly Holderlin's writing on the death of Empedocles, who famous story of a guy basically suicides himself in a volcano. That would ultimately be sort of the ultimate, but I actually think we could take it a step further and be like the ultimate criticism of all that exists in this sort of the ecstatic disappearance could actually just be done by going to outer space, where you do actually get to live, and you might actually get to live out the cosmos dream, you know, like who knows, you know, like that to me is almost kind of like way more interesting than this, you know, Heideggerian fatalist view that I think has been kind of, it's just not that interesting.
Well, it's not dwelling, right? It's not, it's not any kind of Heideggerian dwelling. It's not that kind of mode at all, which is the ultimate, like, for you, for the fourfold, right? It's you know, again, it's outmoded, but I love Deleuze. It's pure nomadology. It's the infinite disappearance into the infinite territory.
That's great. Well, I know you got to get going. So if there's anything else you wanted to wrap up on, that's a good way to end it too.
So. This was really fun, Barrett. Thanks a lot for talking with me.
Yeah, I loved it. This was great. Cool. Well, yeah, I'm going to get to it and I'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much for doing this. This was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Okay. Have a good day. All right.